How did the human race get to where it is today? Why are the people of today the people of today? What forces shape them, either genetically or culturally? Those are among the questions addressed in the book, The Invisible History of the Human Race. Author Christine Keneally brings in hard science, genealogy, personal stories from a number of people, and much more in the book, subtitled How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Christine Keneally is a journalist, widely published in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and a pile of other publications. Her previous book is The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. She lives in Melbourne, Australia. Christine Keneally, thanks for coming to the Jefferson Exchange today.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Could you explain the title, The Invisible History of the Human Race?
Yes, absolutely. I've always been interested in genes and DNA and the way DNA sort of runs through generations of people through time. And, of course, I've always been a bit of a history buff as well. But what I really wanted to do in this book was explore and bring together the forces that shape us that we don't really know about, the ones that aren't so obvious to us. You know, we're all familiar with big history and how the big events of the world have shaped, you know, our century, the world that we live in. But I was just fascinated by two things in particular, the ways in which cultural, really subtle cultural forces may shape us in ways that we don't know about. Those forces operate over generations and lifetimes, and we just have a perspective usually on our own life. And then, of course, DNA is so interesting now, and what's really happened in, I think, just the last 5 years, new techniques have been developed to read and analyze and understand DNA. So what has been invisible to us, this material that we're made out of, the sort of the rawest material of humanity, has been invisible to us for a very long time, but we're just working out the technology to really look at it and understand it and to see what it can tell us about our past and our futures.
The book is divided into sections. The first is ideas about what is passed down are passed down to, which I think is a great title.
Thank you.
Segment two is what is passed down. Three, how what is passed down shapes bodies and minds. And four, the past may not make you feel better. So right from the very beginning, obviously, we're talking about ways in which we pass down things, not just genetically, but as you mentioned, also culturally. I do notice, at least in the first half of the book or so, you certainly avoid the phrase nature versus nurture. Was that a deliberate thing?
Absolutely. I think that debate is over. I think we need to retire it. I do talk about Francis Galton in the book. He was Charles Darwin's cousin. Like Darwin, he was a very brilliant person, and he contributed. He was actually a polymath. He contributed to the science of fingerprinting. He went exploring all over the world, but he also coined the term nature versus nurture. And so really, this is a term from the 19th century. That's how people were thinking about these influences then. But we don't need to think about it that way anymore. We're so much more sophisticated in what we know. And fundamentally, sort of nature-nurture as just a general idea tells us nothing. Because what we need to do really, I guess, is we need to work out what we're looking at. Are we looking at history? Are we looking at health? And if we're looking at health, what part of health are we talking about? Some conditions, some predispositions, other pieces of information in the genome will be shaped more by nature and others more by nurture. And it's a very complicated picture, and you certainly rarely have one without the other. So we need to think, I guess, in a bit finer detail about that.
Given the many fields and avenues of research that you encompass in the book, how is this not a 900-page book?
I think because I was forced to stop, you know. There was a deadline, thankfully, and I was made to actually wind the book up. But there's a lot there, and there could be so much more. And, yeah, maybe the next book will be a continuation.
Christina, I sense a trace of wistfulness in your introduction. Finding out something about long-dead ancestors is fun, but not being able to communicate directly certainly takes some of that fun away.
Yes. Yes, it was a funny experience for me. I've always been interested in those genealogical questions, but I am by no means, a sort of a scholar of genealogy. There are so many genealogists that I've met over the last few years who are really brilliant researchers, I'm not in that category, but I found it so interesting to start delving more deeply into the family history, and I was very surprised to realize that it's not just a journey of sort of happy discovery, that I experienced despair and sadness. And when you get close to these people who are maybe a few generations back, whose acts of bravery or life choices or immigration have really changed your life, and I think for a lot of us, set us up, you know, in a good world with a good life, with good potential and possibility. And, you know, and they had to cross the seas in these sailing boats. It took 40 days to get to Australia. It took very long to get to America. It was a difficult life back then. And when you start to really think about the people who made those choices, you feel a lot of gratitude and sadness, I guess. Maybe there's even a survivor's guilt thing in there as well. They did so much, and we're reaping the rewards.
Which is an interesting way to look at it, because most of us, I don't think, stop to think about, imagine leaving the home that you have known your entire life and going someplace else, And then ultimately your successive generations will be there. But that's the kinds of thing we're talking about here. The Invisible History of the Human Race is the book. Christine Keneally, the author. We'll come back and talk more with Christine and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the Australian journalist Christine Keneally. She is the author of The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Notice DNA and history. Lots of forces that shape us, so it's not a nature versus nurture thing, because it just takes a whole lot of things to make us who we are right now. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. There's an interesting passage here early in the book. DNA illuminates not just the biological past, but the social past as well. Could you explain that a bit, Christine?
Yes. Yes, it is. That's one of the most interesting discoveries about DNA, really, in the last 5 to 10 years, because essentially what happens is that, you know, people make choices about who to marry, who to have children with, and then those children make choices, and they're passing their DNA on in this patterned way. So that really tells us essentially who was getting together with who. So people are able to see now how populations in Europe were mixing 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. There was one really great study that looked at what DNA people have in common across Europe. So there were some patterns that were true for all of Europe. So, for example, lots of people had what you would call a genetic cousin, someone who you just share a small segment of DNA with that's come down to you from a distant common ancestors. And everyone had sort of between 2 and 12 cousins in the neighboring country. And then also that, you know, the further away you got across Europe, the fewer cousins you have. And you would expect that because we, you know, DNA tracks geography and society sort of close together too. But there were really interesting different patterns within each country. So, for example, in Italy, they found that for the last 2,000 years, people have been less closely related to each other than in other countries. And it was almost as if the distance between different regions of Italy were distances between different countries. So that tells us about how few people within Italy, sort of across those regions within the country, were actually interacting with each other. So you get this sort of scope throughout time of how people were blending or not blending together. And in a sort of the larger evolutionary picture, you can see choices that have shaped lives for thousands of years. So, for example, you know, the original natural state for humanity was to be lactose intolerant once they had weaned, you know, once children weaned from their mothers. But certain societies at certain points in time chose to try drinking milk. They persisted with it, and the ones that could tolerate it better did better. They ended up having more children. And then those children, because they inherited their parents' predisposition to be able to tolerate milk, had more children. And so now we have huge chunks of the world that are actually lactose tolerant. And that tells us about a choice that someone made tens of thousands of years ago to give milk a try, you know, and to keep on trying it. And it certainly worked out well for those people.
Well, and then it ends up sticking in the DNA then. And so the social and the genetic are totally inextricably intertwined.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are biological social creatures. We're certainly not one or the other.
You know, I'm curious about the launch of all this, and you do give us a little insight in your book with the story about the family tree assignment in second grade and how that shaped your quest. What happened there?
Yes. So this is something I think most people out there could relate to. They would have had a similar experience at the age of 8. It's a common thing for teachers to talk to children about family trees. So our teacher explained what a family tree was, and she encouraged us to go home and tell our parents about it and, you know, get our parents to help us fill the tree in. What was the name of your grandparent and your great-grandparents? And I found this a really exciting idea, like I think most children around that age do. So skipped home, showed it to my parents. But they were really startled by this homework assignment. They were upset, and my mother's reaction was she sort of felt like it was none of the teacher's business. So that stuck with me for a very long time, and I had wanted to ask questions of them after that point, but felt like I didn't want to upset them. So it didn't become clear until many years later, when I was in my early 20s, when my father and my mother spoke to me and my 4 siblings, and they explained to us that actually my father's father, or the person we thought was his father, was really his grandfather. That he'd been raised by his grandparents, and that his sister, quote unquote, was actually his mother. And in fact, this is a very common experience within Catholic communities. Once you start talking about this, then you find that a lot of people have this story within their families. But for someone like my father, who was born into this tight-knit community in the 1930s, it was a terrible, terrible thing to have occurred. There was a lot of judgment, I guess,
at that time. A lot of shame attached to it, sure.
A lot of shame attached to it. So this had been a secret in our family for so long, and that was one of the reasons why they were so confronted by this family tree assignment. And I think that stuck with me, and it still even today is with me. You know, my father and I, writing this book was almost a way of having more conversations with my father about this stuff.
It's an interesting opportunity to take a fold out of the family tree.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So I'm actually, you know, my father and I have spoken about this, and, you know, he's given me his blessing to go and to try to find out who his father was. And I started that process during the book, but I'm still, it's still ongoing. I'm still looking.
All right, that's the next book. We'll talk about that down the road.
Yeah.
So Christine Keneally is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Invisible History of the Human Race. Family trees, generally, you force us to think about the fact that, oh, yeah, we've got 8 great-grandparents.
Yeah.
Go back another generation, we've got 16 great-greats. So starting to draw this out gets really, really tricky and crowded quickly.
It gets so crowded so quickly. And the really interesting thing about the genealogical tree and the genetic tree is at a certain point back in time, they actually split apart, or not so much split apart as they become different. They're not exactly the same, because once you get back around 8 generations, there are so many people in this vast genealogical tree that some of their DNA all of their DNA for some of them gets lost on their way down to you. So you start carrying genes from fewer DNA, from fewer and fewer of your genealogical relatives. So if you went back in time, let's say 16 generations ago, and you met a whole bunch of your great to the 16th parents, you mightn't be genetically related to many of them, even though you are essentially a blood relative.
Interesting. So it's the influence fades as you go further back in time.
That's right. And yet at the same time, it becomes sort of much smaller, but you still carry DNA chunks from people who lived 10,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, and even further back.
Well, I remember reading there's a lot of stuff in our DNA that just never really asserts itself, but like broken chunks of viruses and retroviruses and all sorts of things like that.
Yes, yes. Well, mitochondrial DNA is very interesting. Mitochondrial DNA is in the mitochondria, which is inside every human cell. So it's not in the nucleus, which is where most of our genome resides. But we can even use the DNA of these mitochondria who became a kind of a symbiote in our cells millions of years ago. We can actually track that back through time, too. And that's passed down from mothers to their children. So it's a very useful little piece of DNA because you can track the female line back through that massive cloud of genealogical ancestors and just follow this one line back tens of thousands of years.
Christine Keneally, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you do write about going to things like genealogy conventions. And I was a little struck by genealogy having a fairly bad rap in some places.
It really does. And that was actually a problem for me when I started reporting the book because, you know, people were very nice and they were very encouraging, but at the same time they would say, you know, genealogy, you know, isn't that when people think that they've all descended from the queen and not a peasant? And even though it is one of the most popular hobbies in the world, and I think we're all very familiar with that, it does have a strange and complicated reputation. And what's worse for genealogy, because it is so interesting, and there are so many good and interesting and robust genealogists out there, is that it's really the educated, sort of sophisticated consensus that it's just silly, or it's not real research, or that it doesn't actually mean anything about who we are. And within mainstream history, and even within some mainstream science, there's quite a dismissive attitude towards this. But certainly what I found is that, you know, it's an incredible way of looking at not just the personal past, but the world's past as well.
But then there must be some sorts of interpretations that and then obviously they're going to be weaker or stronger depending on the person, that people would be, A, either proud to find out, hey, you know, I'm related to a former Lord Mayor of London, or I come from a family of horse thieves. But neither one should really have a bearing on who you are and what you do today.
Well, but I think they can, and I think the interesting thing is to ask that question and try to answer it. And absolutely, we can't just assume that what our ancestors were up to really affects who we are today. There's no sort of necessary connection at all. But for example, in families of immigrants, even people who are second generation in the United States, there are economists now doing work showing that the choices made by grandparents in the old world, whatever the old world of that family is, still shapes the choices of the grandchildren in the new country. And they might be things about the number of children that you have, things that you would actually consider very personal to you. So, but of course, there are so many things that absolutely have nothing to do with us. And I think what I wanted to do with the book was to try to find ways to show what does influence us and what doesn't influence us so we can make better choices for ourselves.
Okay, I think I see the point now. Then if the decision was made, for example, to leave the old country because of famine and come here and establish a business and build a foundation that the family could then grow upon, it's not quite the old joke about the guy born on third base and thinks he hit a triple, but the point being that you at least had a foundation beneath you because of the previous generations.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And it's just about working what that foundation is. But absolutely, I don't think we should go around assuming that just because there's a member of the royal family in our family tree that it really should be sort of affecting our lives now. And the funny thing, of course, about the royal families is, you know, we all go back to the royal families. You know, everyone is connected to them in some way.
Right, right. Or in the American South, where everybody has a Lee in their background.
Yes.
Let's take a couple of calls. We have Jacob in Springfield on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christine Keneally, author of The Invisible History of the Human Race.
Hi, Jacob.
I wanted to point out a typical contribution to diversity and hybridization in our society or the world today. until recently, migration for humans was hindered by vast oceans and large continents. People who lived on the east side of one continent weren't going to meet people on the west side of the continent.
Yeah.
And there was almost limited or no mixing with genetic material except with the people adjacent to you or within your neighborhood. You know, people had to walk, you know, in terms of migration, or after they invented the wheel, it was still very tedious.
But yes.
If we look at modern civilization, the internal combustion engine and the automobile is only 100 years old, and the jetliners are only 50 years old. But I would add that jetliners have actually contributed very much to the diversity of the human race. For instance, our president, Obama,
yes.
His parentage is from Kansas, and his other parent was from Kenya, and they met in Hawaii.
Yes.
And it was all because of jet planes that he was born. He would have been otherwise, never born, because his parents would have never met.
Yes.
Okay. And so what I would say is right now our genetic diversity is being fueled by jet fuel. It's on turbo.
That is an excellent point.
Of human civilization.
All right, yes. Thanks for that, Jacob.
Yeah, look, I think that is so true. And one of the reasons that we can see so far back into history through our DNA is because of those silos that people lived in for so long. You know, people lived together, and generation after generation, their DNA was blended and re-blended over and over again. So that's what actually allows us to identify the existence of different groups way back through time. And a few years ago, I think when we all started to become aware of the implication of the fact that there's so much more mixing now, I think people were talking about how our genome was going to look exactly the same in 50 years' time, because there would just be so much blending across the world. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think, you know, we're getting a lot of great diversity and blending around the edges of groups. I think within groups, a lot of people still like to just stay in the same place and marry the same kind of person, and which, of course, is nice for us because it's going to allow us to read back into history 1,000 years from now. But I think you're right. I think that cultural diversity is very closely connected to that genetic diversity, and it brings us riches that are completely new.
Let's go to Barry in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christine Keneally. The Invisible History of the Human Race is her book.
Hi, Barry.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. I had a question about research in DNA.
Yes.
Is there's a difference between the male and female when you follow it?
Well, there are a few ways you can follow male and female lines. So so we all have autosomal DNA. The vast majority of the human genome is the same for men and women, and you can track families back through time regardless of sex or gender because of that. But you can track back the male line for a very long time and the female line. And for the female line, that's through the mitochondrial DNA that we were talking about earlier. For men, fathers pass their Y chromosome down to children, and that doesn't get mixed up with any other DNA in reproduction. So your Y chromosome is exactly the same as your father's Y chromosome and your grandfather's and your great-grandfather's. And even if there are small differences between them, those small differences can actually tell you something. You know, they're almost like a clock for looking back through time when you see those differences. But you can track fathers and fathers' fathers back for a very long way.
All right, thanks for that. Thanks for the question, Barry. The I'm still writing little notes to myself as we go along here. And if people are still wondering, wait a minute, so life forces affect us differently, even if we have the same or a lot of the same DNA. But then you also talk about twins in the book, about how their own life experiences make them different people over the course of their lives, and they even begin to look very different.
Yes, twins are so interesting. And there's a lot of research out there about twins. But what really fascinated me about them is the ways in which they diverge as life goes on. So they start off with exactly the same genome, or effectively exactly the same genome. As we get smarter at reading the genome, I think people are beginning to find, even with identical twins, there can be tiny differences. But these differences aren't necessarily ones that, you know, affect the shape of their body or how they think or anything like that. And when identical twins are very small, they're very identical. But as people go on, as they experience different different climates, maybe you've got one twin in Australia and one twin in England, as they experience different lives, maybe someone is employed happily for a very long time, maybe one isn't, maybe one twin experiences trauma. I think trauma is something that you can really see in someone's body and despite their DNA. So you will find that they just look different. They begin to look very different to each other as life goes on.
Christine Keneally is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. A bang-up discussion going on here about the forces that shape us, ultimately. You can join this discussion on the Exchange when we come back from the break. We'll be back with Christine Keneally and you in a minute 30. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Christine Keneally, widely published in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and other books. Her previous book, The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. Now we're talking about the origins of people. Her latest book is The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the forces that shape us, not just genetic, not just societal, a lot of everything. 800-838-3760, the number to call anywhere in the listening area. Or you can email us at jx@jeffnet.org. You have some good history in here, Christine, about the formation of the knowledge of genetics. And I'd never heard the story before about who coined the term genes or how that came about.
Right. And so the word gene has only been around since sort of close to the 1900s. And in fact, I think eugenics, this idea of using genes to create a better society, has been around for much longer. And then that actually, unfortunately, has shaped a lot of people's reaction to genes. I think there's a lot of fear and concern today about what our genes mean for us. People are afraid that even to think about genetics is to think about something that is deterministic. And a lot of that goes back to this 19th century, early 20th century history of thinking eugenically, which was, of course, was something that Americans did and then reached its most horrible zenith in Nazi Germany.
And in fact, though, as you point out, and I forget which philosopher it is you point back to, but that the idea of breeding for the best human beings goes way, way back in time.
That's right. Back to Plato, back to ancient Greece. So it's a very appealing idea. And, and of course, humans are animals, too, and we breed animals, and our biologies work in very similar ways. So you can see why it would make a kind of sense to people. But in actual fact, of course, because society is so complicated, and because we are thinking, speaking, sophisticated brains, or we have these sophisticated brains, it's really, it never works out well for human beings. It's not a good idea to try. It didn't work out in the 20th century, and I think the concerns that it might happen again in the 21st are perhaps a little shaped by those past experiences. I think science certainly doesn't live in that place anymore. There are maybe fringe groups who think that way, but this idea is something that haunts us, but I don't think something that's really alive anymore.
On that general topic, we have an email here from Mike in Medford who says, with the ability to see so far back in the human genome, could this information be used to discredit racism and promote the idea that all humans come out of Africa?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the most important tools we have for doing that. And it's complicated. It's not completely straightforward. So certainly when people have looked for race in the genome, and that's been something that people have wanted to do and it's something that people are afraid of, they haven't found it because it just simply isn't there. And one of the reasons for that is that race is always partly culturally defined. It's never just a biological thing at all. It's always about how a society in a particular era defines the different groups of people within it. So it's always flavored by that. But in fact, we can see people's ancestry in their genome, and that is incredibly useful. It's useful for learning about history, and it's useful for learning about people's health and the way they might have different predispositions. But the fact is that everyone's personal history is complicated. Everyone's large group history is complicated and textured and fascinating, and that there is simply no such thing as purity. You know, there's old, awful, ridiculous ideas about race. There's no purity in the genome. There's nothing like that. And certainly DNA doesn't tell us that anyone is better than anyone else.
We have a bunch of good questions here. Here's Brad in Ashland on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christine Keneally. Her book is The Invisible History of the Human Race.
Hello, Brad.
Hello, Christine, and thank you, Jeffrey, for letting me on. I love the discussion. There's wonderful call-ins today, too. I've been thinking a lot about the naming in our culture. When a woman has a baby, you know exactly who the mother is, especially if you watch it come out of her, but
yes,
you're never sure who the father is. So the name of the family is the father's, and I think that's an attempt to usher, A-S-S-U-R-E, what is unsure, U-N-S-U-R-E. So there's always a little bit of a question as to whether the husband is the father of the children. And there's a lot of things around that that have consequence around monogamy norms and this and that.
Yeah.
But it intrigues me that in terms of tracking a mother's history, you're always going to a woman who has gotten a name from the father side of the family that she was involved with.
Right.
And then even her maiden name is a father's name. So I was really intrigued with your notion of tracking mitochondrial DNA and the exact mother. Is that what you're saying you can do?
Yes.
Exact, instead yes. of four parents, there's only one grandmother that's the actual one, and they can track that?
Yes. Yes. Well, it tracks the female line. So if you go back to your grandmother, and this is true for men. Men can track back, they track back mitochondrial DNA through their mothers. You know, you might go back to your direct your maternal grandmother or your maternal great-grandmother, and your great-grandmother's sisters will have the same mtDNA as well, but you can track back through your line that way. I think you're probably right. I'm sure that anxiety about paternity shaped the ways names were chosen. When, you know, when 700 years ago in England, when names actually became hereditary. But those conventions are changing now too, which is so interesting as well. A lot of women don't take their husband's names. A lot of children aren't named exactly for the father's names. And that's going to be a challenge for future genealogists.
Oh, true. Hyphenated names and combination
yeah.
names like Villaraigosa, the former mayor of L.A. That was
right.
a combination name with his wife. We have an email here from Mike in Phoenix, Oregon. He says, as an Ashkenazi Jew, I have found it almost impossible to trace my lineage before 1900, mostly due to pogroms, persecutions, and that little thing called the Holocaust. Is DNA analysis the only way to garner information on Jewish genealogy?
Well, if that's the case in your family, then DNA analysis could potentially give you a lot of information. And one of the most powerful things about DNA analysis now is not just this idea of working out what kind of Y chromosome you have in general, but when you get your DNA analyzed with one of the big companies, there's Ancestry.com, 23andMe, Family Tree DNA, you send your sample in and you essentially become part of this very large database. And the company works out what segments of DNA you have in common with everyone else in that database. So you essentially instantly find yourself surrounded by cousins. You might be lucky and find a first or second cousin you'd never heard of, but you will definitely find third cousins, fourth cousins, fifth cousins. And what's remarkable for people in your situation is that you might find someone who is a genetic third cousin, and they may also be someone who have their genealogy worked back many generations. So people are able to sort of get in there, find these cousins, and actually find documentary evidence as well after sort of finding this genetic connection to begin with, because some information is being passed down other lines of the family.
Is it that explicit? I mean, can you know from DNA analysis that it is a third or fourth cousin or second cousin?
Yeah, it can be a bit fuzzy around the edges, but they've worked it out pretty well. And that there are basic rules that, you know, if you have a certain amount of DNA in common with someone, it generally means, you know, you are this much distance from them, essentially. That there's always going to be exceptions. And the good thing is those exceptions are always interesting, too. Like, there's usually a good reason, and it might tell you something else about your family that you didn't know.
We have another email here from Scott in Ashland who brings up a really interesting point. He says, although the number of positions on our family trees increases as we go back multiple generations. At some point, given the small size of the human population in earlier times, the absolute number of our ancestors must start to decrease as we go back generations, because the same individual was occupying multiple positions in the tree, e.g. the same man was great-great-great-grandfather on both our mother's and father's sides.
Take
the Roosevelts, for example. My question is, how many generations do you have to go back before the number of ancestors starts to decrease rather than increase?
Well, what they said, so first of all, let me agree, that's actually a fantastic point, and it's absolutely true. And I think the idea is, if you went back about 3,000 years and you were just expecting that you would get that doubling with each generation, there's the two parents, the four grandparents, the eight great-grandparents, you would have about 120 trillion people. This is an uncountable number of human beings in this theoretical family tree, when in actual fact there are less than 200 million people alive in the world at the time. So you do get this incredible crisscrossing of lines throughout humanity and through the genealogical tree. But I think that even in the 20th and 19th century, in many societies, there was cousin marriage as well. That's a really common thing in American families, in English families. It was actually a conscious choice for many groups to marry sort of within the family. People married first and second cousins. So you might be going back three generations, and you're going to get that kind of what the genealogists call a pedigree collapse, where one person occupies at least two roles in the tree.
We have an email here from Tim in Eureka. He says, I'm fascinated by the ability to track migration patterns with DNA. The Human Genome Project seems to correlate with linguists' migration mapping of language. I have two, and this is up the two alleys of the two books you've written already. I have two questions. One, did all terrestrial animal lives' DNA also migrate from East Africa's Rift Valley? That's one. And the other one, what are the inconsistencies of the Noah story within our DNA?
Can you recap the first question for me again, Jeffrey? Did all terrestrial life
migrate from East Africa's Rift Valley, yes.
I don't think so, because humanity, modern humanity in the form that we're familiar with ourselves today, has been around for about 200,000 years, and the idea is we spent a lot of time in the Rift Valley before then, but I know that there were other animals all over the world, so I think it's just humanity, and you know, that was our home for a very long time, but the rest of the world was being populated by different animals. And the Noah story, you know, I don't know that anyone has found any evidence of that. So what the Noah story is, it's essentially a story about a bottleneck. When you have a large population that suddenly shrinks down to a very tiny population, and then everyone who lives after that point has descended from that very small remaining pool of people. And there are many bottlenecks throughout human history, and they're incredibly useful for telling us about our history, because all of a sudden, it means that this huge range, this huge diversity of DNA has disappeared, and we're coming funneled through just a few different people.
I'm struck by the number of ways in which the fate of future generations is influenced by what happens to previous ones. I mean, obviously, there are the natural disasters, things like the plague, which you do detail in the book, and, you know, mudslides that can wipe out entire villages. But then you also think about the things that humans cause, wars, and then you go on at a fair length about slavery.
Yes.
And the huge change that made in the world.
Yes, that's right. And it's so incredible, that work. That's all really new work that's being done in economics. And it's amazing, because this in particular, the slavery story, is these two economists were looking at levels of trust in modern-day Africa today, and not just, you know, trust in your government, trust in your local police force, but intrapersonal trust, the trust you felt for your cousin or your sibling. And there was a survey that sort of gave them this information. And what they did was they looked at the levels of trust today, and then they looked at how many people were abducted into slavery from those regions and from those particular population groups more than 100 years ago. And they found this really powerful correlation between that where many people had been abducted, you know, were disappeared overnight, and in many cases had been betrayed into slavery by people in their own community because they were trying to save themselves, essentially, that levels of trust today are even now shaped by those horrible events.
So the countries left behind are somewhat, are a lot poorer in a lot of ways.
That's right. Yeah. They're doing much worse economically, and there's a lot of work nowadays showing that, you know, just trust in society is, of course, a huge component of our economy. If you don't trust, you're not going to trade with people, and it really you can't get off the ground if you're not a trusting group of people.
I want to bring it back around to Australia for you, because you go on at some length about this in the book. Is it a matter of pride in Australia to be related to one of the convicts who came off the boats?
Yes, it is. Thank you for asking, Jeffrey. And I would like to just point out that I did indeed have a convict ancestor when I was in high school. That was around the time that it became kind of cool. It was actually a terrible shame in the family before that, and secrets were kept for generation after generation. As a teenager, I asked my dad, you know, do we have a convict in the family? I wanted to go back and tell my history teacher at school, and he said no. And, you know, he wasn't lying. He didn't know. The secret had been kept from him. But in fact, the woman who raised him was the daughter of a convict. So it was very fun to turn that up in the end.
This is Michael Deegan.
This is Michael Deegan, my 15-year-old convict from Dublin. Yeah,
I want to finish up asking about the Mormons and why one religion is so focused on genealogy and has this Granite Mountain Records vault in Utah.
Yeah, the Mormons is so interesting. They, part of their sort of religious charity work is essentially to make this massive database, genealogical database, available to people. So I guess it's all about, for them, it's all about Joseph Smith, their founder, and his doctrine, but they're making this huge amount of data available to the rest of us for free as well.
All right. The book is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Future. Christine Keneally wrote it. Christine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It was so much fun.
It's a pleasure.